Council, we're going to go ahead and start our council meeting now. It is Tuesday, June 16th at 7:03 PM. And we are meeting in the community, Cedar Hills Community Center. We are going to start with a pledge. Who would like to lead the pledge since Council Brandon's on here?
I would be happy to.
Thank you. We're going to start with a pledge led by Councilmember Geddes, and then the invocation will be given by Councilmember Miller.
All right.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our Father in heaven, we are grateful to gather here this evening as a community, as a city. We are grateful for the rights and liberties that we enjoy here in this land, for the peaceful community in which we live. I guess that will bless each of the staff, the council, and mayor tonight to be guided to make decisions best that are best for the residents of our city to maintain and enhance the things that we love and enjoy about it.
Thank you. Moving on to item number two is an approval of the meeting's agenda. Somebody would like to make that motion?
I'll make the motion to approve tonight's meeting's agenda.
Motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Miller. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. So move on to the public comment portion of the meeting. I don't see anybody here. Laura, I'm assuming you'll speak during your item if you need to. Okay. I don't see anybody here for public comments, so we will go ahead and close that portion of the meeting and move on to the consent agenda, which is the approval of the minutes from the May 19th, 2020 City Council meeting. If someone would like to make that motion.
Sure. I move that we approve the consent agenda.
Motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Geddes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Moving on to items 5 and 6, or city reports and business, starting with Mr. Goodwin.
Yeah, we want to thank our golf staff. They've been working in some pretty interesting circumstances over the last 3 months, but they've managed to have a really spectacular spring and moving into a really wonderful summer in terms of the number of people that are utilizing the course. We're very grateful for the many contributions they make to the city. They've done a really wonderful job. The course looks wonderful, and we've gotten a lot of good feedback on the course. Events are starting to pick back up again. We've been working with Utah County Health Department on the guidelines that are set forth from the state, and we're communicating that with the clients, and we're shifting some of those events that were scheduled for May and June and April. We're seeing those being rescheduled for July, August, and September, so we're cautiously optimistic, I should say, about some of those events being able to actually be held. And then some of the events that we have in the building are starting to pick up too in our rec classes. T-ball and coach pitch begins on Tuesday. We are following social distancing guidelines and the guidelines that are required by the state in terms of checking temperatures of the participants. And so there's going to be a lot more responsibility on coaches and field supervisors to make sure that we're following those guidelines. But I believe we've met with the rec department and they're ready to hold those programs. We've started doing high fit classes again a couple times a week with social distancing again. Karate, the same thing. There's a limited number of classes, but we are starting to see some more people coming into this building for things other than golf, so we're excited about that. I do want to thank the fire department and the police department for their help on Saturday for the Family Festival's events. We got a lot of good feedback, even though it was a very limited Family Festival this year. I did hear a lot of positive feedback about the car parade and the fireworks. And we're grateful that the fireworks didn't start 5 minutes later than they did, because we would have had a problem.
It got real windy.
And then finally, Harvey Park is open. We've gotten a lot of good feedback on Harvey Park, but we do ask for people's patience as we troubleshoot a number of items that are still having issues with down there in the park, specifically related to the splash pad. That's all I have.
Thank you. I want to echo what Chandler said. When it comes to golf staff, I know that it has been a wild ride this season, but it's my understanding, and Greg or Chandler, correct me if I'm wrong, but golf has had financially the best year that they've had, the best season that they've had.
Yes.
So thank you so much for that. That is incredible to say at this time, with everything that's going on right now. That's very impressive. And then again, just wanted to thank staff for all of the work that was put into Harvey Park. It is a fantastic park. I hear great things about it, not just from residents in Cedar Hills, but I've heard from people in American Fork and Highlands and Alpine and Pleasant Grove, who all think that this park is incredible. So, and you can tell by how busy it is anytime you go down there, but people love it. Good news, the East-West Connector has commenced. Yes, there is work being done. It will be known as Canal Boulevard, but work has started on the west side.
Wait, you're going to change the name?
It's going to be Canal Boulevard, which already is in Highlands, because it will connect to their Canal Boulevard on the west side, so that will be the name.
Yes, good months, and $800. 40 of them on one pole, then finally gets to Harvey.
And then
now
it's going to
change to...
Welcome to Canal Boulevard. Yes, Canal Boulevard will be called, but they have started, which is great. And so they're anticipating being done in October. So we will.
By the way, they started on the other end first. So.
Yeah, they started on the west side first. But they have started, which is amazing. And then I did hear back from UDOT. I sent them some pictures and some video footage of what the intersection of Canyon Road and SR-92 looks like on the weekends, which is just a mess right now. They did indicate that as they are resurfacing SR-92, that they are going to restripe that intersection so that if you're turning west from Canyon Road onto SR-92, there will be an accelerator lane, so you're not competing with traffic coming out of the canyon, which would be nice, but it doesn't really alleviate the, if I can even get left out of there. And they acknowledged that, and so they said that they are interested in doing a traffic study, but they probably won't do that until after construction's over, because they anticipate construction's going to make it miserable anyway. So we'll see what they decide to do. He said it doesn't make sense to do a signal there just because it's not really a problem most of the year. It's only a problem on the weekends and the summer. So I don't know what the solution is going to be, but they are adding that accelerator lane for those heading west from Canyon Road. And that's all I have. That's impressive.
I want to add again to the Harvey Park praise. I'm hearing nothing but fantastic things about it. I have a friend. They took their kids there and they spent 8 hours in one day. Just great. Just absolutely loved it. So well done. Good job. The only question they had is why wasn't the splash pad running on Sunday? I didn't have an answer for them on that. But
I will tell you that what I shared with residents, because we have to talk about this, is, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but we don't have public work staff that work on Sunday. So if we have mechanical failures or wind or low temperatures, we cannot control it remotely. So we would have to send a member of our team out to address it, and we're trying not to send them out on Sundays if we don't have to. That's my understanding. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, so I've got an answer for him. That's great. No, Brian's down. So I took Amanda there the other night. I didn't realize it was 9:30 at night because the place was completely packed. And there were lines and people with chairs outside the pickleball courts and everything. It was just baffling. Fantastic job.
Echo that sentiment. Thank you for the answer, because I've got that same thing. Why wasn't open on Sunday? But it makes logic sense. I'm fine with it.
Yeah. And, I've researched a few other cities and nobody has the ability to control their splash pad remotely, so it's just.
So it might be a good one for you to, you know.
Right.
Saying that, yeah, to just mention that, and also mention that people ask, well, are you wasting water? I've heard that too. And if you'll explain that it's culinary, but then it becomes the eye.
Yeah.
And it's recycled. I think that's a terrific thing to let people know that.
We can do that.
If nobody knows.
I will write that up, and then we can also put it on the website, because we're going to do policies as far as hours and stuff. We'll just add it to that.
So,
great. That's great feedback.
My kudos to the Recreation Department and staff and Public Works and everybody working through this last issue. I mean, the golf course has just been phenomenal. Every time I've been up there, I've played a few rounds during this time. It's just busy, and there's just families out there. There's, you know, I feel like there's more women this year than I've ever seen in my life, more kids. And I just think we're getting a good reputation. Thank you. And make sure you see the final numbers through June 30, but it's pretty phenomenal already, no matter what we think from here on. So, one other thing I'd like to just for the record, I was deeply moved by the death of David Shaw, and so I just want to acknowledge that and he'll be missed as a member of City Council and as our city. I will miss him deeply.
Thank you.
I just want to reiterate that about the same thing about the park. It's been wonderful, and the feedback's been positive. And also, Austin David Shaw is respected by many, will be missed. And then I would comment that, again, that the parade of fireworks were awesome. I sat in the roundabout or the center part of the Wagon Wheel area, and there were a lot of families that had come out, kids playing at the park waiting for it, and it was just a lot of people, probably not socially distancing, but still having a good time. it was great that we were able to do something. And thank you to all those that are involved, that were involved in the town festival committee and our law enforcement and fire department.
Great. All right, thank you. So we'll move on to item number 7, which is a review action on the golf course driving range for Jeff Homestead.
I'll be honest, I was expecting an audience for this meeting.
That's why we're here, right?
Yeah.
You're not wrong.
You know why? Another chance, I mean, I expected.
I was like, did we notice this wrong? Did we notice this to be like a Harvard Park or something?
No, I didn't
notice. It's noticed right. I guess they're just having fun at Harvard Park. I guess we can come soon.
We should start holding our meetings at Harvey Park. We'll have people attending them.
That would be amazing. How did you do six meetings so long? What
exactly.
Record numbers. But I'm going to go through a while ago, and this has been this presentation has been kind of in the making for a number of months. But a while ago, we had a discussion with the council about the driving range, and specifically about. We were getting a number of complaints about people, about the number of balls leaving and the safety hazard that it posed possibly to passersby, and cars as well. So council and staff, we worked through a number of, I want to say 10 items that we felt like could possibly resolve what we were seeing as the problem. And I want to dive into those 10 items and kind of give staff's feedback on them as we kind of evaluated them over the course of the last few months. This was a presentation we wanted to give in March, I believe, but everything's been interesting since then, so this kind of got put on the back burner. But nonetheless, it's still an issue that we have to discuss and evaluate today. So bear with me. I was going to finish this presentation today, and all of my permissions on Microsoft on my computer expired, and I can no longer use any Microsoft products on my Microsoft Surface. So I only got so far, so part of the presentation is done, part of it's not. But here's an aerial view of the driving range. And what we wanted to look at was how the various options that we're looking at, how would they affect the driver, the people using the range, how would they affect the people on hole 18, and how would they affect this neighborhood here. This intersection right here is really kind of a critical juncture that's in question. So keep that in mind as we go through this presentation. Option one was increasing the height of the middle sections of netting. So this is harder to see than I had anticipated, but the netting extends from about this point all the way to about this point. And we identified about 7 sections of poles out there, and you got a nice view just behind you. But you've got 7 sections of poles where we said, we could raise these sections of poles. We reached out to the company that designed this netting and said, for these poles, how high can we go? And the answer is 10 feet. Beyond that, the poles are not engineered to go any higher than 10 feet. These poles do carry a substantial wind load. As you can recall, that was the reason we went to steel poles, is because the wind knocked down our poles before. But the cost to go up that 10 feet is roughly $30,000 to $40,000. And at this point, it's undetermined what effect that would have on keeping the balls in the range. I don't know the answer to that question. They do radar studies where you can see where the balls are flying, but without doing something so specific, I don't know exactly where they're flying over and how high they're flying over the net. option two was increase the height of all the neighborhood. The number that the neighbors have thrown out as the magic number is 80 feet, but they've also said 80 to 100 feet. The poles that you see out there right now are 50 feet. But something to keep in mind that while the poles themselves are 50 feet, they do sit, and it's very clear as you drive by, they sit on a berm. So they're raised up higher than the area that you drive from. So from the lower tee box here to the top of the pole, it's about a 65-foot difference in the from where you're driving to the top of the pole. It lessens as you come back and use maybe the mats on the cement area. It's probably closer to 55 to 58. It's over the pole. I got some photos I can show you to illustrate that gradation change. But if the city were to pay to raise these to 80 feet, you're looking at a complete rebuild. As I said, you can only go 10 feet higher on these, so you'd have to bring in completely new poles. We're looking at $450,000 based on that. And that's the same company that did these poles. They did a wonderful job. They did a great job on the poles. And so while that's not, hasn't gone through the procurement process, we'd obviously get bids from other companies, but that's a placeholder number that you could probably expect to budget for, plus minus 30% on any bids you got. Option three was angle the tee boxes away from the nets. And we've tried this to a certain degree. We've initially lined them up so that they're all hitting away from the net rather than straight down parallel to the net. They're hitting slightly away from the net. And the ones as you'd be closer to the fence here on the south side, we've angled those even further. So you have the line of where you hit is angled, but also the tee markers are angled themselves to emphasize hitting away from the net. What that does, though, is it puts all of our golfers that hit on 18 in danger. There's no net here to protect them, so they tee off up here. And for most golfers, I'd say, their second shot is somewhere in this range on the course. It's the lucky few that their second shot is aiming for the green, but typically you're before the pond. So without adding a net here, you're looking at another $100,000 to put a section of netting in there. Option four was to move to the range to irons only. We've been doing a study that I'd like to share with you, trying to determine what the number of balls that are leaving the course are. And this is the study as it stands today. We started this on May 13th. This blue section is irons only from the lower tee box. And you can see that we've got the number of balls that are picked up on the golf course side, and you've got the number of balls that are hit and picked up on the south side. So basically, the way of thinking of this is balls that went over the net but stayed on city property, balls that went over the net and left city property. And this is the number of small baskets that are sold, the number of large baskets that are sold, and then employee buckets, we assume are large buckets. And then based on the number of balls in each bucket, on an average, you've got 31 balls in small buckets, 62 in large buckets. We can determine the amount of balls, an estimate of the amount of balls in each bucket. Now, from that number and what we collect, we can determine what percentage of balls are being collected that are leaving the course. And then we can determine from that what number of balls are leaving the course and going off property. So it's really this number right here is the one to look at, not necessarily. Because if the ball goes over the fence but stays on our property, I don't care a whole lot about that ball. But if it goes off our property, that's what I care. But I do believe it would be naive to assume that we pick up 100% of the balls that leave. I get it, kids walk by, they pick up balls, balls fall down the street in the storm drain. So we added in a margin of error, and this can be played with, but Excel will randomly assign a percentage to multiply this column of balls going off and over the net, off our property by a percentage, and then giving us an estimate. And so the average percentage right now hovers between 1.1 and 1.2% of balls leaving property. And that falls within the expectation of what we assumed would be the amount of balls leaving. I remember when we raised the nets to 50 feet, the question was brought up, how many balls will leave the property? I believe I said about 2%. But that 2%, when you have, thousands of balls being hit a day, represents a number of instances that potentially could lead to a bigger instance. I was going to say that. So this blue is the section, this blue section is lower T's, irons only, and then you add the drivers in. And you see that there is a slight increase in some of these numbers, but it's still within, on average, it's still within the 1-2% range. And that's assuming our margin of error is somewhat correct. We could play with the margin of error numbers and make it 200%, but it's still probably close to 2% to maybe 2.5%.
The blue is irons only?
Yeah, the blue section right here is irons only. And
it's not substantially different with drivers.
Yeah, so the average of that blue section is 1% according to this. The average of the drivers is 1.2.
The same.
So the neighbors said that they noticed a difference. So that's just what they observed. And I believe them because they live it, because he said he noticed a substantial difference. And so that's why it's hard to pin this down into what is an exact number. I don't know if that's possible without actually counting exactly how many balls are in each bucket, how many balls are picked each game. That would be so prohibitively expensive to do.
I can't see that from this. Can you tell me the numbers, just irons only, and the numbers for drivers?
Which number?
The numbers that you collected that left the...
Yeah. So for irons only, during the 2 weeks, the number of balls, the total number of balls that are hit off that we can actually count?
Yes.
So the total number of balls there are 119 during that 2 weeks for irons only, and then for drivers added into the mix, it's 164.
So you're already ahead of it. Can I add something to that?
Please.
I think it's a little bit skewed at the very beginning, too, if you notice that. And you can probably review that.
Yeah, it's hard to see, but yeah.
It's double digits
at the very top. And we believe that that's because we're picking up balls that were there prior.
Okay.
So if you exclude those, then you kind of start to get a more realistic number. And that's why I think it's important to do the study over time and not just look at one day. It has to be done over a set of time. And then you see that we're back in an irons only phase, but we're on an upper T. So we're hitting a little bit higher, a little bit further back from the lower, it's a 20 feet back, and it's maybe 3 or 4 feet higher. And we're seeing on average 1.3. So it's still 1.1, 1.3. It's within what we would expect to see. So anyway, that's the study I wanted to show you that we've been doing. The staff has been, I want to commend the golf staff because I know that's a headache to do every night. They've been doing a wonderful job of it. But moving the range to irons only would present a problem because you still have balls that go over the fence. But there would be some financial repercussions for the course. Most golfers, I believe, go to the driving range to use a driver. So there would be a lot of people that would not use the driving range. Well, that would reciprocate itself in terms of rounds of golf play too, because they would go to a range that they could hit the driver and then play golf there. So we anticipate that if the range were to move to irons only, then there would be some negative consequences financially for the course. Another idea was to switch the driving range direction. So rather than hitting west to east, we'd hit east to west. This is a really interesting idea, but probably one of the more expensive in that you'd have to build a trail for the carts to get over to the far east side. You'd have to still put in netting to protect hole 18. You'd have to put in protective fencing up here to protect the users of the driving range from errant balls from up above on the tee boxes. Not to mention the grading that would be required for this area. So I believe this would just be, if this is the case, then let's do just raise the nets to 150 feet. I think this is just too expensive. And then we also talked about shutting down the range for separate tournaments. This, Mike, you can probably speak to this, but like I said, a lot of golfers really come to hit a bucket of balls before they hit, when they go out on around the course or around the golf course. So you're really seeing a diminished green fee revenue as a result from a decrease in play at the range. So then we go back to, so this is where my presentation shut down and I can no longer use Microsoft products on my computer. One thing we talked about is adding a golf fee for repairs, just leaving the course as is, saying we're going to have a good neighbor policy. We've looked at that, Craig provided a policy for Murray that I believe would be a great starting point for discussion on this type of policy. And I think that maybe regardless of what we do with the driving range, it's not a good policy that we need to consider because we have areas, other areas on the course that are affected by the golf course itself. My primary concern there would be damage to homes, not necessarily to automobiles, but to the actual adjacent homeowners. So that's something we can talk about.
Well, personally, as a city, we've had requests at least 3 or 4 windows in this building.
I wish it was one.
5.
How many?
5.
5? Okay.
They seem to be more and more, I'll be honest.
Which surprises me because it has to be a really
weird
angle to me. It seems like most of them should glance off, but I guess it's the second shot in either shame.
One other thing we've done is we haven't bought new targets, but if you go down onto the fairway, and you can see them down there on the fairway right now, you can see the yellow yardage marker there. We've moved those are the targets, we've moved those to the north so that they're pulled rather than being center of the driving range. We've moved them to the north so that people are looking, if they're hitting towards those, they're automatically compensated to north. But I don't believe that adding targets would be a very effective way of dealing with the problem. One other interesting idea is to drop the elevation of the tee box. And this is where, it's hoping that we have audience here because it takes these great pictures. But thank you, Greg, for the talk. You can see these are the mats, the cement mats at the top that you can hit from. And then you have the middle T-box area, and then you have a lower T-box area. So from here, there's kind of that standing, but that gives you kind of a perspective. You do drop quite a bit as you go down to this lower T-box. So one of the ideas was, well, let's punch all of this down, including this lower T-box, because the driving range sits in a bowl, and the T-box area is actually a lot higher than where you're hitting into. So we have room to push that down to the ground rather than raise the nets. We push the area to drive from lower to lower elevation. It's undetermined what the cost of the excavation and irrigation and resodding would be on that one. That one's $200. We'd have to get an actual bid from an excavator. And then finally, going back to the presentation, one of the final ideas was to move the tee box area to the north. So right now you can see this little area right there. That's an old bunker that was used at the driving range practice. So you have a little bit of area where you can push the tee box away from the nets a little bit. I also think that this would probably have a marginal effect, not necessarily the desired effect that you're looking for. A couple other ideas that came up during the evaluation. Staff had multiple meetings on this, but one of the ideas was a safety fence along the top, and it's similar to what we have that runs through hole one. It's a fence that runs along the path, and then it angles over the jogging path there to protect anybody who's using the path. We could build something similar to that along the path here, give pedestrians and bicyclists a safe path from 28 point B as they come by with the fence area. Another item that we need to discuss is the range fence length. When we moved to steel poles, the fence got shorter, and that was because when we were putting wood poles up, it wasn't a big deal to put the poles where they needed to go, but the weight of the steel poles was such that we have a sewer trunk line that collects all the sewer for the cedars up here and runs it right through the driving range and then down through the city. And the reason, if you look out at the net, you can see that there's sections of netting that are closer together, they're not all the same distance. The reason that is because we had to space it so that we didn't have a steel pole that was sitting directly on top of one of that sewer trunk line. And what that did is that shortened the length of net that we were able to have. So an idea would be to pull the netting out further. We feel that there's a number of balls that leave the property because they're being hit not high of leaving the net, but far, and they have a slice to them, so they actually go they're actually hit from the driving range and they slice out around the end of the net and maybe roll down the hill, hit the road up in here. So we do see a significant number of balls in this area on our property. So with all that, I know that's kind of like a lot to take in. I apologize, it's maybe a little redundant too, but one of the proposals that the residents there made was that the city should look into a golf course trajectory study. And I was initially reluctant to pursue something like this, and then I know Greg had an initial conversation with a gentleman named Dave Tanner. He works at Tanner Consulting Group. I think he probably is Tanner Consulting Group. But he works with PGA and a number of golf courses all around the world in terms of designing range, designing golf courses and driving range, but also designing golf course and driving range solutions. And so what he does is he evaluates your course. He doesn't come out here, but he evaluates it using data that's publicly available. He looks at the elevation, looks at your gradation changes, he looks at wind patterns, he looks at the existing fences, the heights of the existing fences, temperatures that you see, all these affect the flight of the ball. And so then he can make recommendations, because what he does is he will then run through each club that you would possibly use from a pitching wedge all the way through your drivers and uses the most popular types of clubs, and then he'll run through all these scenarios saying, okay, based on what the course conditions are, he creates a 3D model of the course and then runs through these scenarios of every club and says, here's what you can expect to, here's the number of balls you can probably use, here's the percentage of balls you can expect to be leaving the course. Here's my recommendations on what you should do. And quite frankly, I'm not certain if our driving range is below normal, above normal, normal in terms of the number of balls that go over the net. I just don't know. But for the cost to do the trajectory study, I feel like the amount of information you get from that would be well worth it to the city. And I know I'm sharing my opinion here, but a lot of these options that we're going through are very expensive options. Some of them are not expensive. We tried them because they're free. But before, my recommendation to council would be that before we pursue any major overhaul change to the golf course, we look at a trajectory study. It's the cost of the trajectory study is $3,550. And it can be done in 10 days. So we can have a trajectory study presented to you at the July 7th meeting. At that point, we can talk about budget amendments. If they recommend that we make major changes to the golf course, we can talk about budget amendments and timing of any capital project related to the golf course. We are proposing tonight that one of the budget amendments is an adjustment to the professional technical line item of the golf course fund that would then fund this trajectory study. So, I'm sorry I've talked too often on this item. What kind of questions can I answer?
So I'm going to read, Councilmember Anderson sent me a statement she wanted me to read to the council. And I'm just going to weigh in and go down the line. So she says, Mayor, City Council, I regret that I am not able to attend tonight's City Council meeting, but wanted to be able to voice my opinion in favor of going forward with a trajectory study proposed by staff tonight. I feel it is in the city's best interest to go forward with the study, even knowing that it will cost $3,500 in these budget-strained times. I know that we have poured a lot of money into the driving range nets recently and have done what we felt was best to mitigate the air and balls flying over the net, but apparently balls are still going over. I know that it is 1-2% of all balls hit on the range, but they add up. I am aware that staff has come up with some feasible solutions that are low cost and easier implemented than raising the nets, and I am in favor of trying these as well. Having the trajectory study done will help us find other solutions or confirm to us that we are on the right track. Either way, I think it is important that we do our own due diligence and seek professional advice moving forward. That way we can with all certainty say that we have made every effort to solve this ongoing problem. I want to lay this issue to rest as much as anyone else, and I feel that having the study done will help to reach a conclusion that will be satisfactory to all. Councilmember Denise Anderson. So just to add to that, Councilmember Anderson and Councilmember Geddes and I and Chandler met and Hiron met with Mr. Haar, Mr. and Mrs. Haar, and Mr. Nielsen, who live over in that area. And it's clear from conversations that we've had with them in the past and this most recent conversation that our intent originally with the fences was to to mitigate, not eliminate, but to reduce the number of balls going over the fence. And at the time, I think Chandler did say that he thought it would reduce, it would limit it to 1 to 2% that would go over. And that's, in essence, what we're seeing. But to their point, depending on the number of golfers we have and the number of balls that are hit, that can add up. So, you know, 80 balls a week, if that's what we're seeing with drivers and irons, it can add up quickly for the people who are living on the other side or recreating on the other side. It was interesting when I went out there with Craig and Greg and Chandler. I was there, was it 3 weeks ago? With everything happening, I had lost track of time. But I was out there for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and Chandler went to walk across the street just to talk to somebody, and the ball came over, and it was pretty close to hitting Chandler in the head, right when he was in the middle of the street. So it was evident to see the number of balls. I mean, yeah, there were probably three, I think, that came over the fence just in that short period of time that I was sitting there. And one of the frustrations that I think that the residents over there have is that while we have done things to mitigate it, they are correct when we say we haven't done anything based on any kind of a professional analysis that tells us this is going to help. We just said, let's raise the nets to this level and this is what we think will be the outcome. But we haven't had anybody professionally say this is what you should do or this is what the impact's going to be of what you have done or whatever the case is. And so in my mind, having the trajectory study by a professional will allow us to really understand what challenges exist for our driving range based on a professional's opinion. And I believe when you spoke with him, he even gave you some suggestions that we hadn't even considered that could be potential solutions that were pretty minimal changes, pretty small changes that wouldn't cost us a lot. So there, even talking to him just briefly, there were some things that he mentioned that could be done that weren't on this list of 10 items or whatever. So from my perspective, having talked to the residents, having talked to staff, I also support the trajectory study because I feel like it allows the city to say we've had some outside perspective come in from somebody who this is what they do for a living. They can give us some suggestions. Maybe it's that we don't need to change anything because we are in line with other driving ranges. Maybe there are some small things we can do. If they come back saying the only option is to raise the nets to 100,000, we can justifiably say financially that we cannot do that. And the residents there were very clear that they don't expect us to do that. They don't expect us to put $500,000 into this. They made that statement more than once when we met with them. So I think this would give some peace of mind for us as a city and for the residents that we have somebody else not involved in this day-to-day to come in and say, here are the challenges that your course has, here's the things that you can do, and then the council at that point can decide whether or not we move forward with them. But at least then we've had that opinion made. So questions and thoughts from the council?
So, since I was in the same meeting, I'm going to just two cents in. And I agree mostly with what the mayor said, and I think in some respects, it makes a lot of sense. I spent some time reading Craig's analysis, and I felt like we're pretty covered from a legal standpoint. I'm not too worried about that. Protecting the citizens of our city, and I think that's number one. I've asked a question publicly before, how many people have ever been hit? What year is something else? 14 years?
16 years? 17. 18?
18 years and zero, although when we met with the residents, it is a lady had told them she was hit in the leg on the rebound or whatever, back on a bounce. But she never reported it to the city, so we don't know anything. But so, I mean, I totally understand why the push to do a study. I think it's just money just flushing down the toilet, in my opinion. I think I've been here 18 years. All due respect, I asked the bars if they'd even look into putting up a net themselves. And he said he had, but it was expensive. And even though I understand we gave them our old net, so could have put it up, and I point out the fact that I golf all over the country, and anytime people live on a golf course, which choose to live near a golf course, I mean, that's their choice. The Harz bought the house. The Harz bought the lot after the golf course was here. I mean, that lot sat vacant for a long time. There were balls on that lot for many years, and so it wasn't like it was obvious that there would be golf balls on their lot when they bought it. So, I mean, I'm sympathetic to them But I also know that if you live near a golf course and you're worried about golf balls hitting your house, you put up a net, protect your own property. That's what everybody does in up and down the state of Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Washington, where Montana, I just got back from golfing there. It just seems there's some personal responsibility that needs to be made, and if it's really not an issue with the public, which I don't feel like it is, I just think any amount of money spent is just a waste. And so I'm opposed to it, but I understand everybody's position. I respectfully disagree with you, Chandler, and Jenny, and Councilmember Anderson.
Yeah, I'm somewhere in between. I think it is a looking at the numbers from your study, it really does look to me more of a perception issue as opposed to an actual issue. The numbers from the irons, not significantly different from the drivers as well. So, and the fact that they say they saw things being significantly better then throws a big red flag in my mind statistically that their focus, they've got an internal bias towards one situation as opposed to another. That's fine and good. So essentially this to me is $3,600 to fix a perception issue. It's disappointing to me that it's gotten this far. It's we do have some tough times with the budget right now, and it's really a tough decision, putting in my mind the cost versus the perception that I'm seeing here. So in the end, yeah, I think I will go ahead and favor this just because the data may be useful. We don't know. We don't know. If it comes back and says we should be expecting a ton more balls going over that net than actually are going over, well, we got a problem with the study. So it's really tough for me to look at that. So, yeah, I don't know.
I acknowledge the validity of all the opinions that have been expressed. I think it is hard to spend that amount of money and not know if the results are going to be useful in any way or lead to a conclusion of something that's economically feasible. But it seems to be a problem that isn't going away. We've tried the freebies, the tweaks and adjustments. I think that in consideration of what we're trying to mitigate, it's over 18 years, it's really a low risk but high impact situation of the possibility of somebody being hit. And if somebody gets hit square in the head, it can be fatal, I guess. But the odds of that happening are very low. But I think that if it were to happen, we want to be sure that we were reasonable and prudent in our decision making. I think I support doing the trajectory study. I think that it could produce some information that we could use, and it could be useless in a sense, and we won't know, but I think we should do it.
If I may, a couple of thoughts. In just talking to the gentleman that runs the Tanner Consulting Group, was that golf is a sport that evolves over time, and people's abilities are enhanced by the equipment or the lack of equipment that they use. So he gave the example of Tiger Woods and botched the numbers, so Greg might use it correctly. But he said that back in the day, 12 years ago, Tiger Woods was a long driver on the PGA Tour, and he's hitting about 280 to 300 yards. Well, today he's hitting like 330, so he's hitting a lot farther than he was, but now he's 50 on the tour. So the equipment has changed and allows people to hit the ball farther and harder than it did when the course opened. So there's The course, the range limiting that we have when we built the course may have been sufficient. But I think that the trajectory study gives the city an opportunity to say, you know what, we have is sufficient. Or if it comes back that, you know, minor changes, and he even gave the example, and I don't think this would apply to our course, but he gave the example of sometimes putting a tree in a specific spot changes the whole dynamic of the way people hit. And so it could be something as simple as that. Some of the examples that the mayor alluded to were that another change that he suggested was, you know, something you could look at is just to angle the tee box, the gradient of the tee box down about a percent and a half. It angles it down into the ground, but it's small enough that the golfers don't technically notice it. But what that does is it changes the height of the ball drastically at its apex. Another thing you can consider is the height of the tees that they're hitting from require them to hit from mats. And so rather than, you know, teeing off a 3-inch tee, you tee off an 1.5-inch mat that you're supposed to hit off of the rubberized tees that you have there. And these are costs that in the long run, I think, are financially benefit the city. I told the residents in this meeting that I can't in good faith tell the council to, you know, hey, we've got financial struggles. You remember our October council meeting last year, we talked about some of the issues we were seeing in the budget, and we're seeing some of those come to fruition, but I can't in good faith say it's in the financial best interest of the city to spend $500,000 raising events. I can't say that. But $3,000 trajectory study, I think, puts the city on a really defensible position in what it's going to do about the trajectory, about the driver. So if the trajectory study comes back and says, you know what, your range is designed fine, and the number of balls that you're seeing is within the margin of error that you would see at a normal range, you know, to me that puts the city in a defensible position. So in the long term, a lot of the things that we consider on staff is the liability that the city faces, and I think that this actually helps us and secures our position in a better way than not doing it. And I think that's probably one of the strongest arguments of my argument from a staff perspective.
Anything you want to add, Councilor Smith?
Just that I agree with everyone, which makes me equally conflicted, because there's a lot to, I agree with Mike just as much as everybody else. I'm super sensitive to the budget and the things that, you know, we're spending it on. You know, to the perception issue, I think that's maybe what the trajectory study will help with, is that the perception may be that we're doing nothing and we've looked at nothing and we haven't done our due diligence. And I feel like this at least could help with that perception issue, even if we can't.
You know, with regards to your comment with the clubs and how technology changes, that's always going to be a situation. So that tells me this study won't only be valuable for a certain amount of time, which means we'll probably have to do it again. With that in mind, I'd like to, it could be used year round if it's virtual, that doesn't do any of the outdoor risk stuff, to start looking down the road at options. That's all.
We have looked at that.
In 10 years, maybe it's a heck of a lot cheaper than they're raising.
All right, unless there are any further comments or questions, I will take a motion.
I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve staff to engage in agreement with Tanner Consulting Group to perform a trajectory study of the driving range.
Motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Miller. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes 3-1. We'll move on to item number 8, which is a review action on a resolution authorizing the mayor to execute a lease agreement for the grill space at the Community Recreation Center.
Just as a note on the last item, that will be reflected in one of the budget amendments that we're proposing on the golf professional technical line items. So, okay. A much more palatable, discussion item. Now, we have a review action tonight on leasing out our grill space. We've met with Laura Blanco on a number of occasions. She's looked at the kitchen space, and Craig has provided a kitchen lease agreement. I want to go through some of the basic provisions of that kitchen lease agreement so that you understand what we're proposing to enter into. First of all, it outlines a basic understanding of the space that's going to be leased. It defines the grill space area, and it defines common areas that both parties have access to. So you really have anteroom as you walk into the Vista room, and then you have back to the bathrooms. And so both parties have access, obviously, to the hallway and the bathrooms, but the grill space is hers, but she would have, you know, code and alarm access to that other portion of the building.
Hey, can I interrupt? Did they ever cut the door to the...
No. It defines the landlord's and the tenant's obligations in terms of what each is supposed to do with the building. For the landlord, you're in charge of the common premises, so that hallway, bathrooms, that's our responsibility. We're responsible for the utilities into the building, that's the gas, water, power, those connections. We're also responsible for the damages to the building itself. The tenant, their obligation is for the leased premises, so everything inside the grill. And the biggest item there is the equipment, making sure that the equipment is being taken care of. So any damage to the equipment would be the responsibility of the tenant. It lists the equipment in the leased space area, so that we have a basically check-in, check-out item list of the stuff that we have, the things that we purchased there. And it outlines a flexible rent schedule, like we discussed in the work session, where it's $550 for the busier months of the golf season, April through October. And then during the winter months of November through March, it's down to $100. And the reason we've done that is because we see a great decrease in the number of people coming to the building during that time. So we want to be able to work with the person that's in the lease area. Making them successful. To offset that, it's important to remember that Lars' background is in catering, and I'm really excited to try food, but the incentive is for her to work with the event staff, because we're saying that there's going to be rent share, or there's going to be revenue sharing in terms of not grill sales, but for catered events in this room. That events that we bring to her there would be some revenue split there. We talked briefly about the section on possibility of taxes paid by the tenant. Obviously, sales tax is required. There's not much discussion, any discussion there. But in terms of property tax or use tax, that's something that we're going to have to talk about with Cheryl and see what language we can get there. What we've used in the past to show the county that that's not subject to property taxes. Talk about shared revenues. We would require a deposit of $500. To be clean the building professionally in the event that the tenant left. And we do want to allow for a flexible schedule to be worked out between Laura and staff. And because, you know, weather changes, the golf course is shut down, and when the golf course shuts down in summer months, this building really shuts down. And so there's no sense in her staying open during a time when nobody's going to be in the building. So you want to be, even though there's posted hours, you want to be able to have some flexibility there to work with the tenant. Those are the basic provisions of the contract that I think are the most important to point out to the council. What we're asking for tonight is, Craig and I have gone back and forth on some of the red lines for this agreement. I told Laura before the meeting that I'm hoping to have a final proposed copy of the agreement to send to her for her comments and concerns. And then I want to ask the council to authorize the mayor to execute that agreement. What I went over right now was the substance of the agreement. I don't believe that changed. I think that's stuff that we've talked about with Laura and with the council before. There could be some minor adjustments and some wording, but I think that the framework, the basic bones of the agreement are in place. What questions can I answer from the mayor and council on this?
I'm just going to add, if there are any significant changes, then obviously we've been back before it was executed.
Sure. What would be the time frame to start?
August
1st or something, or July 1st?
I would like to see in by the end of June, if it's possible. I'd like to execute the agreement as quickly as possible, and give her access to the space immediately so that she can go get the Utah County Health Department and inspections, and the fire inspections, and start ordering product to be sold.
Laura, did you have something you wanted to add?
No, okay. That, you know, we depend on the agreement in order to, you know, go further with the health department.
So I think that agreement is something that we can probably have the majority of it ironed out by the end of this week. And so the reason that we want to do give authorize the mayor to sign that agreement is because we don't have a council meeting until July 7th. So we want to give a lot of flexibility to the open machines to go ahead and visit the majority of the golf season.
I promise not, we won't make any crazy changes.
Yeah. Totally excited.
As much as I love the golf course hot dogs, I'm really excited.
I've had Lawrence food, I can vouch for it. That's amazing.
Nothing beats an empanada.
There are no further questions, then.
I'm more than an empanada.
There are no further questions. I will take a motion.
I'll make a motion. I make a motion to approve resolution 6-16 2020 AIS. Authorizing the mayor to execute a lease agreement for the growth space slash kitchen facilities and equipment located in the Tony Recreation Center.
Motion.
We add substantially in the form as.
Substantially in the form as the draft has been proposed.
Motion made by Councilmember Geddes. Is there a second?
Okay.
Seconded by Councilmember Smith. Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Laura, you don't have to stay if you don't want to. You're welcome to, but. All right, moving on to item number 9 is a review action and public hearing on a resolution adopting fiscal year 2020 budget amendments. I will open the public hearing first. Is there anybody here that wants to speak to the budget amendments? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing and turn the time over to Cheryl.
You need my computer?
Okay, the first item is the budget amendments for FY 2020, and in the general fund, I have a line item for the CARES grant allocation related to COVID-19, and I don't really think we'll recognize all the revenues or expenses in this current year, but just in case, who knows? Maybe there'll be something crazy in this thing. So, whatever money we receive and we don't spend is considered a liability. So that's how it'll show on the books. If it's not eligible expense. That's the first two items, and they're $719,000. That's a
very over.
Okay. Charles, it's easier for you. You're welcome to just take that microphone down so you can see it. We can all see it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I'm just not sure what he's doing.
Just click and drag it like it's going off the screen to the right. To the right. Click on the blue and see if you drag it to the left, it'll pull it back onto your desktop. It's treating the monitor like it's a second monitor to your right. It's not mirroring the display. There you go.
Okay. That is good. Okay. Hopefully you can see those.
I can't.
Any other comments?
I have good eyesight. Let's see that.
The second area is the family festival reductions we made because of COVID, which basically just funded fireworks and the car thing. And we returned most of the donations, I believe, except for the fireworks. The next is some roof repairs at the public safety building. They weren't quite, they were around $6,000, but there's been some major repairs this year. And then on a positive note, the departments have been very careful since March, and because of that, if they are careful for the next 2 weeks and nothing comes out, I think there's a chance we could actually max out our fund balance in the general fund and transfer some money to a couple projects, which is amazing. Like I said earlier, Utah was saying there was a lot of internet sales made when people were indoors, and some, they said on average it was going to be flat, but like our March was like a record March. It was pretty much as good as Christmas. So.
Because as you saw, everybody was shopping at Walmart.
Walmart. We have a key retail that people, yes. Walmart, Taco Bell, and McDonald's. So, you know, we just have the hot items, I guess. I don't know.
Is Hearts still okay here?
I've talked to Hearts. I've talked to Hearts, and there are a few things that they just can't keep in stock, like wood. And ice, they can't keep it in stock because people want the wood to go up the canyon and want the ice to go camping. They're doing really well.
I'm assuming they took a hit with gas.
With gas, they took a hit, but all the goods in the store, they're doing well.
And then, we talked a little earlier about golf doing so well. We're showing that. By reducing part of the subsidy down. They've actually done so well this year that we could have eliminated the subsidy, but we want to allow them to use that money for golf equipment, future investments into the golf course. Then on the golf side, the recent discussion, and I think the study is like 3550 or something, so I've only got 3600 for professional technical. And then every year we have trades with vendors that provide food or media advertising, and that happened again this year. And then we have a project I'm just showing the potential that we could transfer money in, depending on, for example, if we have $4 million in revenue at the end of the year, we're allowed to max out at $1 million, 25% of that in the general fund as unrestricted.
without getting comment from the state or from our auditors that we have too much. This is really good because the last 2 years we've had great years financially, but we've been drawing down significantly for Harvey Park, and we had a drawdown for the Long Peak contract buyout. And to be able to build that up in 1 year is pretty amazing. So, then water and sewer, this is something I'm just trying to balance a decrease on the last budget adjustment we made back in April. I decreased the transfer that goes into water and sewer, and this shows the water and sewer side. I need to balance that. So, those are all the amendments. Do you have any questions? Are there any things you'd like to change or add to it? Let me know.
There are no questions from the council, then I will take the question.
I will go ahead and make a motion to adopt resolution number 06-16-2020B, a resolution adopting the amended 2019-2020 fiscal year budget for the city of Cedar Hills, Utah.
Motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Miller. Councilmember Miller?
Aye.
Councilmember Guest?
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth?
Aye.
Councilmember Smith?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. We move on to item number 10, which is a review action and public hearing on a resolution adopting the fiscal year 2021 budget. And I will open the public hearing first. Is there anybody here who would like to speak to this item? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and call you again, Cheryl.
If you want to pull up this first, you have a compassion. Just wanted to show on the revenues. So on the revenue side, you'll see that on the tax revenue, I had initially proposed a sales use and tax drop of $250,000 based on what we're projecting this year. And after the news I got from the ULCT, I actually think that should probably go up $75,000. You can say we're pretty conservative, but still at 12%. That will bring our overall imbalance to around 20,000, which is pretty good. It would bring our revenues down so $500,000 from what we're projecting this year. This year we're having a great year, mostly due to the first three quarters. We were having such an amazing first three quarters. And kind of coasting into the last quarter. And still having a very good year historically, not quite as good as last year, but probably within 100,000 or so. Most of the cuts for next year, we had to do relate to programs. Oh, you got it, show. Thank you. So that slightly different color is red on the right, and that's all the places where See, in the third column, it's not last year's budget now, it's where we're projecting right now for the year. And our certified property tax amount is around $720,000. But we're only projected, some people paid late, it's the delinquent tax. So that's what we're projecting, 711. We'll ask for 730, which is the certified amount this year. But it could be a little bit less what we actually get in current year. I had 1250 here. I think we're okay from the 1325. And I don't have any other changes from what you have on your sheet. But just showing a slowdown in building, and I don't know if I've seen that. We're not seeing new construction permits for connections, but we're still, people are, like, you know, at Home Depot at Rose is busy, so people are still doing improvements and doing more. So maybe this number's too low, but we can change it in a couple months if people are still going crazy on their home improvement projects. Passport fees we talked about earlier. Right now we're only getting about a couple thousand more. When we see that open up more, people want to travel more, then we can raise that, but until we see that. And then yes, worked. So then our next, you're seeing that criminals went down most. On the expenditures, our biggest differences are we are basically just minimizing any possible costs we could think of. And then where we had the biggest savings, I mean, we had you guys went out for legal contractors. Even though this is showing 20,000 more, our original budget was more than 120,000. We're just projecting around 100,000 right now, so no litigation last 2 weeks.
What about next year?
No litigation next year.
Ever.
And
then follow counsel.
Yeah. Yeah. Just living a bubble.
Yeah.
The mayor council budget, the only thing that really changed there is ask for a little more money for the planning commission and a little more money for training and then we reduced, we got rid of the life insurance benefit. We had some turnover in our admin part time, and so we're expecting that to be a little bit less. Plus, we cut back hours because our admin part-time does a lot of passports. So if we see the passports volume go up, then that we would need to increase maybe some hours on that. If you have any questions about any of these sections, I'm just going to slowly go through them, and if something like bothers you, then let me know. Public safety, we have a 2% increase. We're also showing the liquor expense and revenue moving to AF, and so that's why it's not showing the full 2%. It's because the liquor expense that we showed isn't on here anymore.
Is the fire not showing the increase for the building for the rent?
We're not projecting them in that building.
We're not projecting it this year, and if it does happen, then we'll
project. For 2021, you're not projecting that. Okay.
Yeah.
So you can see Public Works, if you look to 2019 to 2020 to 2021, it's like half what it used to be. You remember, we are recognizing half of their allocation that was going to Public Works now in Class C roads because they spend so much time doing road maintenance. And so you'll see that later on the Class C roads. That's where that money went. And that, that seeing a bigger increase with now these full-time people we hired for parks are going to be here year round. That started at mid-year. And then our apartment supplies and maintenance went down because half of that used to be part of the Wilkinson contract. So we no longer have a contract outside of the city. On the part-time salary wages for community services, that's showing a reduction in hours because of the reduction in rec programs and in events. If that comes back and we have big programs and big events, then we'll raise the part-time hours. So that's the biggest number there that we see a reduction. And then the other big reductions are we're not showing transfers out other than the substate to the Gulf, and we reduce that for next year to 100,000. So in Gulf, this is where they're projected right now for the current year. You can see compared to last year, they're killing it. It's 150,000 for green fees compared to 570 the prior year. We're not going to just assume that they're going to have the exact same year. Like to see a couple of 2 or 3 years before we jump that high. We're being very conservative in our golf budget, and we're showing actually lower numbers on pro shop than our historical averages. We're being pretty reasonable there. And then we do anticipate a strike, like drawdown. Like right now they're projected around a fund balance of 350,000, and that this budget would require a drawdown of about 32,000 of that if they spent every penny and they met the rate. Class C roads, being very conservative on this because these numbers could be much higher based on what I'm hearing. But right now, we can change that in a couple months. But right now we have the gas tax money, 80,000 less than what we project this year. We have the highway sales tax, which is new sales tax money that has helped us. At only 80,000, but I haven't seen a drop off on the sales tax, like I said, so that could easily be $120,000 next year. We'll just watch it for the next few months. And then these are new line items that were split with Public Works. Now we're showing the actual wages that are used on streets in this fund. This is our golf debt service fund. It's the same levy as prior years, and we're drawing down on the existing fund balance, 13,000. Capital projects fund, main difference from last year is we're just not transferring money in, at least at first. Hopefully that changes. So as you can see on the water, the revenues, zero rate changes for water fees, storm drain, 2% reduction for sewer. Then here's the changes for on the expenditure side. We anticipate our engineering costs to be lower. That's probably the biggest change. And our bond interest will be, since we paid off the bond, we'll have a lot less bond interest. We don't have too many major projects going on in water sewer right now. I know our main focus is just trying to get splash pad working right now. Water pool fund, we have three vehicles scheduled for replacement. We'll see what the flatbeds sometimes will hold longer, and so we'll just see what the market maybe is at the time next winter and see if everyone's on shutdown, we might wait on that one. But there's another truck and a pool vehicle. Okay, that's the details. Was there any line items that you guys had any questions about?
There are no questions, and I will take a motion.
This is C, right?
Yes.
All right, I'll make a motion to approve resolution number 06-16-2020C, a resolution adopting 2020-2021 fiscal year budget in the city of Cedar Hills, Utah.
Motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Councilmember Smith. Councilmember Miller?
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes?
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth?
Aye.
Councilmember Smith?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. We move on to item number 11, which is a review action on a resolution certifying the calculated 2020-2021 real and personal property tax levy.
I just wanted to give you a little background. I had a PowerPoint. But so as you can see, I was talking earlier about how our census numbers are looking, which affects 75% of our sales tax is from population. So as you can see, we peaked in 2017, and now we're going down. And maybe that will go back up with some of the housing. I don't know. But then you have, see, Alpine's pretty close to us in population, Linden's pretty close, Highlands almost double, so forth. And then here's the different operating amounts for each city. We have 730 as our certified property tax rate this month, and this year. And the next lowest is Alpine at 1.7 million. That's pretty huge. Even if you add the 220,000 we have for our public safety fee, we're still much lower.
Which is, to me, quite fascinating because I hear a lot of cities boast that they have one of the lowest tax rates in the county. Yeah. It's meaningless because clearly they're still bringing in quite a bit more revenue than we are doing our tax rates.
Per house, they're bringing in a lot more.
So,
yeah. So I just wanted to give that background. And I talked about this earlier. Councilman Smith wasn't here, but if you see the utility rates this year, even though we're raising recycling and garbage slightly, the net decrease is 43 cents if you use about 6,000 gallons a month. So your bill should go down next year. So, anyway. property tax rate. For this year, it is at only 001646 in total, and we're operating 001160, and for the debt levy, it's 0.00486. This is nothing more, nothing less than what our new growth is. This is probably your first time, but so what that means is they do evaluation. If all the houses go up, they reduce the rate. Let's figure out what the same amount, so we get the same amount, and then they add on Taco Bell and new houses. And that's about $10,000 for us. You compare that to the other cities in the slide, it's very small compared to what the other ones are getting. Any questions on this? I'm sure you just want to go home.
There are no questions on the certified tax rate or how it's calculated. I will make a motion.
I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve resolution number 06-16-2020-D, resolution setting a total property tax levy assessed upon real and personal property for the general governmental purposes for the 2020-2021 tax year for the city of Cedarville, Utah.
Motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Geddes. Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Move on to item number 12, which is a review action on a resolution adding, amending, or deleting certain fees to the official fees, bonds, and fine schedule of the city of Cedarville.
I'd like to commend staff on coping with a very difficult budget year. I mean, remember, like I mentioned before, our total meeting where we talked about the forecasting revenues for the city and how we were seeing issues on the horizon. And then when we met in January for our annual budget retreat, I know that we were taking a very pessimistic outlook on the economy and its impacts on Cedar Hills, general funds revenues especially. Little did we know that we weren't pessimistic enough, so we had to go revisit those assumptions and reduce the budget even more. It's been a series of a great deal of belt tightening in the city, and there's been a lot of big do without purchasing needs only. So that's been challenging for departments, but like Charles said, I think that the outcome is going to be good for the city in terms of the unrestricted fund balance and financial health of the city. So I commend staff on their office. So thank you. On the fee schedule, we're not proposing to change too much here tonight, but we are proposing that you formalize the utility rates in the fee schedule that were part of that adopted budget. So that rate change, you can see a decrease in sewer, you can see a slight increase in garbage and recycling. I think the big change on the fee schedule that we're proposing is for credit card transactions in front of us that are over $300. We're proposing that there be a 3% surcharge on those, excluding any that are related to utility bills, but that there be a 3% surcharge add on to these fees so that we're covering our credit card expenses with the major credit card companies. What this does is it covers our expenses, like I said, but it also allows us to take money in a more convenient manner for a lot of people. Are there any questions on that?
So just over $300, right?
Just over $300, yeah. Okay. And because right now we will take payment on items up to $300 and we will charge. So $300 is kind of determined to be the threshold where it impacts the city the least.
And we pay that when people do it for the utility bills, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions? No, I will take a motion.
I'll make the motion to approve resolution number 6-16-2020-E, a resolution adding, amending, or deleting certain fees to the official fees, bonds, and fines schedule of the city of Cedar Hills, Utah.
Motion made by Councilmember Geddes. Is there a second?
Second.
Motion made by Councilmember Smith, is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Miller. Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Gibbs.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. We'll move on to item number 13, which is a review action on a resolution authorizing the mayor to execute an agreement with Utah County regarding the receipt and expenditure of the CARES Act funding grant.
Yes, thank you. The CARES Act, as you recall, allocated money to various states to be used to help counties and entity liabilities that were impacted by the coronavirus, unexpected coronavirus expenses. The state of Utah received, $507 million, really, that one. But Utah County, more importantly, Utah County received $111 million. The Utah County Commissioners met with the mayors to agree on a way that money was to be distributed. So about $111 million. Initially, they carved off $20 million to be used for relief, stimulus, and nonprofit efforts in the county. With the remaining money, the Council of Governments organized and have a direct decision-making authority on how that $20 million is spent, but the rest of that money is going to be divided by based on population between the county and the various cities. And what that does is that we're receiving that money directly from the county. The county is the one that ultimately is on the hook for money that's used improperly with the treasury. So the county is asking the cities to enter into an indemnity agreement with the county that should that money that the city received be used improperly, it's the cities that have to repay the money to the treasury, not the county. And so this is a good thing as the city, well, right now our expenses related to the coronavirus are not great. They're not too huge, but they do exist. But what this does is it allows us to prepare to really kind of get the things that we need. We're spending a lot of money on PPE, on sanitation, and sanitation efforts here at the golf course and at our building. Not to mention the unemployment claims that we've received. But there's a number of expenses, and we've been tracking those for the last few months. But this indemnity agreement has been kind of called into question for the last few weeks in that some of the city attorneys in Utah County have expressed some concerns on how it affects the city and some of the language that they're using in this CARES Act agreement. So the two concerns that are most important to Cedar Hills is that any money that the city does not use by November 1st has to be sent back to the county, and that will be used to further stimulate the local economy. But the cities want to make sure that any contracts that they enter into that go beyond that November 1st deadline, that encumbrance is treated as an expense in terms of the indemnity, and that money does not need to be, it's encumbered, it doesn't need to be returned to the county. That's one concern. The second concern is that they want to clean up some of the language to, I believe, match the intent of what the mayors and the county commissioners agreed to, in that if a city improperly uses money, they're responsible for their own money. If another city or the county improperly uses money, not the rest of the cities are on their rights. So they want to clean up some of that language. But in substance, the agreement is laid out and is agreed to amongst the parties. And that's why with our next council meeting not being until July 7th, we want to ask the council again to authorize the mayor to execute the agreement once the Utah County Commission and the various municipalities in Utah County have agreed to what that language looks like in any form. Any questions on this proposed indemnity agreement?
I said this in the work session, I'm just going to reiterate here, that's the intention of the county, so I don't anticipate that they're going to have any concerns with those language changes. And just to Craig, as you're working on this, I know we're saying if it's been, that we've allocated it by November 1st, we don't want to send it back, but we do have to also make sure that we follow the Treasury rules, which is it does have to be spent by December 30th, so it can't be money that's spent after December 30th.
Yes.
We have to actually, so it's only really 2 months that it's been
used. And I don't even anticipate that, I mean, right now in our discussions on what we would possibly be spending money on, some sort of contract has not come up, so I think it's of small importance to the city. However, it's tough to determine what that would look like if there is a second way we start shutting things down.
And the only pushback that I can see the county might give to that is, again, if it's not spent by December 30th, it has to go back to the treasury. So they might have a little bit of heartburn that if a city says, I'm going to spend it, and then they don't, it doesn't get reutilized by the county. It has to go back to the federal government. But again, that's small. I don't think there are any pushback, really. Any questions on that? Not on the table motion, please.
I'm going to make the motion to approve resolution 06-16-2020-F. A resolution, is it F?
Yes.
Yes.
A resolution authorizing the mayor to execute an agreement with Utah County regarding the receipt and expenditure of the CARES Act funding grant. Do you have any subjective recommendations? Just to capture the minor modifications that were expected.
I would have to say, probably like I had earlier, that it's agreed to in substance of what's presented tonight.
As so with the following recommendation that it's essentially a substance of what we've discussed tonight.
Thank you. Motion made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Councilmember Smith. Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. We'll move on to item 14, which is a review action on a resolution and ordinance adopting a flood damage prevention plan.
Yes, this is a resolution and ordinance that's been proposed. It's a little strange. But this is from the federal government. This is from FEMA. And we've had this on the agenda, I want to say about a month ago. And there's a number of follow-up questions that I wanted some clarification on in terms of how this national floodplain, which flood insurance policy affects the city. So some of the questions I had was, they said that, well, the residents, what this does is when the city joins the NFIP, is what it's called, residents can then buy or purchase FEMA-backed flood insurance. And they said, well, if you don't join them, then you can't purchase flood insurance. And that is true in that you can't purchase FEMA-backed flood insurance, but you can still go to the private insurance market and purchase flood insurance. And to date, I've never had a resident ask to why can't they purchase FEMA-backed flood insurance. And the reason I think that is because we do have a flood designated floodway and base flood areas in the city, but they're all down on the whole 10. There aren't any structures in Cedar Hills that are within the floodplain. The only structure that we have that's in a floodplain is our golf maintenance building, and that's not in Cedar Hills, it's in Iowa, actually. So you can purchase private insurance that would cover you for flood insurance. But one of the concerns that we had was that when you adopt this code, that the city council, you have to adopt it wholesale. You can't adopt it piecemeal. I went through there, it's about 18 pages of code, and I struck out sections that were not applicable to Cedar Hills in any way, shape, or form. Like, what do you do about recreational vehicles in their floodplain? What do you do about manufactured homes in the floodplain? And we don't have any of this. So, but in our conversation with representatives from FEMA and the State Floodplain Office, you have to adopt it all. And that was a great concern to the city. And I'm just trying to understand the ramifications in our discussions with these members of the state and federal agencies. We wanted to know, well, what's the drawback? And the big drawback that I can see if the city does not choose to join is that the state of Utah will not allow Cedar Hills to apply for hazard mitigation projects. And this includes earthquake, fire, and flood mitigation projects. But as the mayor said, we don't have any mitigation projects that we have on our capital projects horizon. That doesn't mean that there will never be any, but right now there aren't any. But I don't know that we were going to apply for federal or state assistance to begin with. Mortgages won't fund infrastructures in the floodplain unless the city joins, but like I said, we don't have any mortgages. I hope we never have any mortgages on Hill 10. All the city is in a low to moderate risk, which means that the residents could get a flood insurance that would cover not just damage to the structure, but also cover personal items lost. And then I told you about the chocolate shake and the chocolate cake designation, and that the instance that we had here on the hillside in 2005 with the mudslide was chocolate cake. It wasn't too thick to be considered covered by the NFIP. It has to be chocolate shake, so it has to be completely inundated by water. And they have insurance agents that would make that designation. From the city's requirement, there's not any requirement for training. There's no cost for the community to join. There's no annual report. We would be required to create a floodplain development permit, which we would then have to issue to ourselves every year to, in order to do any activity in the floodplain. And an activity in the floodplain was just a really, in our conversation with the representatives, it was a really nebulous term. So I didn't know if that meant irrigation repair at hole 10. I didn't know if that meant like dredging the debris basin down there, removing the trees that come out from the spring runoff. It was very nebulous what that meant. But I think that the issue here is that my big concern is that you are adopting 18 pages of code that you can in no way, shape, or form modify. Right? And you adopt definitions, you adopt statutes that may actually conflict with other definitions and statutes that you have in your code. So I have some real reservations about joining this program. I think I made that clear, but I do want you to understand what I see as the ramifications of joining versus not joining. So, I know I've probably covered stuff in the past or answered questions about this in the past, but what questions can I answer in this moment? I may have glossed over something.
Do we need a motion against, or do we just let this die with no motion? I mean, we haven't called for motion.
It's against, and it's the one you want
to. I saw that one. I didn't know.
This is a unique one in that typically we do a resolution or an ordinance. I would just say to not approve the city to enter into the NFIP program. But that's the motion you're looking to make.
Yeah, I'm on the same page as you on this one. I don't see, from what you talked about, I don't see a benefit that outweighs all the costs of bureaucracy.
It does, it's a good way to put it. It does seem like we're creating a bureaucratic mess and we're only affecting ourselves by it.
Most importantly, if you vote against it, she'll stop calling us up on. Or if we vote for it, she'll stop calling us up on. I just mean, maybe decision one or the other.
They do, FEMA does, they do modify floodplain maps every so often, and it will be for a number of years, but in a few years when they go back and they revisit their floodplain designations and maps, that might be a time when the city comes in and says, hey, we want to look at our floodplain designations, because this is what they're asking us to adopt is the highest, most stringent code for floodplain areas. And I think, to be just quite frank, I think that's absurd given that we have no homes in floodplain area to adopt the most strict code related to floodplain area. So when they're doing modifications to their maps, there could be some work that we do with FEMA to redesignate some of those areas in order to take a much less stringent approach to this, and then look for a program.
All right, Council, I'm ready for a motion.
I'll make a motion.
All right.
I'll make a motion to not approve the proposed resolution and ordinance related to the flood damage and prevention. We direct the city hall staff not to join the National Flood Insurance Program.
Motion made by Council Reyes. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilor Ellsworth. Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Gaines.
Oh, wait, did it need a resolution number? No.
No.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Will you just email the vendor?
Cool.
Move on to item number 15, which is a review action on a resolution designating the city of Cedar Hills as a 2020 Utah Heritage City.
I think this is a really great way to interview tonight. And I want to thank Mayor Reese for her efforts on working with the Better Days 2020 on getting this designation for Cedar Hills. If you're not familiar with the Better Days 2020 movement, it's to recognize Utah's role in the suffrage movement from 150 years ago. And I know that they had great plans this year for what they were going to do to celebrate. And unfortunately, with everything that's been happening, all of those plans have been just kibosh. You know, I think that at some point they had a Martha Hughes Cannon statue that they were going to put on tour of the state, and we'd arranged for them to post it here in this building. Ultimately, its destination is the U.S. Capitol. And it's really unfortunate that can't happen. So I commend the Better Days 2020 group for looking for other ways to kind of recognize the historic role that Utah has in women's suffrage. And Cedar Hills especially, I think this is really great for the Cedar Hills community. We are the only Utah County city that was chosen to be a heritage city. And what they've done is we've got a scavenger hunt that people can go to visit all of the heritage cities, and there's a packet at the front desk that they can come pick up that kind of leads them on their quest, if you will. But we're proud to recognize Utah's role in the women's suffrage movement and those leaders that advocated the right to vote and the various women in Utah's history, that recognizing their role, recognizing their efforts in women's suffrage. It's a really, really cool thing. So if you haven't followed them, I would look them up. They've done some really exceptional things this year given the circumstances. Mary, if you want to add that?
Just pay the scavenger pack. It'll be fun.
There's a limited supply front desk, so.
Yeah, it sounds really fun. I just wanted to commend the mayor, because I know this has been a passion of hers, and she's kind of spearheaded it for the city, and so I appreciate her effort.
Yes. Very, very cool.
Well, if there are no questions, I'll make a motion.
I'll do this one.
Okay.
Hey, I'll motion to approve resolution number 06-16-2020-G, a resolution designating Cedar Hills as a heritage city for the year 2020.
Motion made by Councilmember Smith. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Miller. Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Smith.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. I will take a motion to adjourn.
I'll motion to adjourn.
Motion made by Councilmember Smith. Is there a second?
Aye.
Seconded by Councilmember Geddes. All those in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned.